You know what? Get over it, because we've got a country to run and that's what I've demanded of them.
I wish ScoMo and Joshy every success.
Government members do not trust each other.
I'm a bit lost for words. That doesn't happen very often. The Wrap.
It's the end of the week. Time to wrap up some of the biggest stories from the last few days. My guests this week, Stephanie Peatling. She's the Deputy Federal Editor in Canberra for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Age. And the co-host of the Signal podcast, Angela Voipier. Welcome to both of you.
Hello. Hello, thanks.
All right, this week has been about tax. The government is fighting hard to have the three-stage tax cuts passed. And Steph, they won. They Woo-hoo. Got there.
They got there. They did. With the help of Centre Alliance and Jackie Lambie, who's back in Parliament after an 18-month holiday away from it due to some issues over her citizenship, they got there. So the centrepiece of the election campaign, which was really not all that long ago and was fought largely about this tax package, has been signed, sealed and delivered. And people will start feeling the effects of that in their wallets pretty soon, depending on how quickly they do their tax returns.
Okay. So Matthias Cormann was pretty adamant that the government was not engaging in horse trading throughout this process, but that's kind of what happened, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, there's some great line about no one ever wants to see how the sausage is made, isn't there? he certainly took that line with One Nation, and that's maybe something we should come back to, because they were never part of the negotiations on this front. But Centre Alliance has talked to the government about energy. They're very worried about prices, particularly in the state where they are based, which is South Australia. And Jackie Lambie also secured an agreement from the government that it would look at the Tasmanian state government's public housing debt to the Commonwealth government. And she was pretty open yesterday when she agreed to support the government's tax cuts, that they hadn't promised that they would actually do anything about it, but they would, you know, take her concerns on board and talk to her about that at a later date. So I don't know how Matthias Cormann defines horse trading, but that to me certainly sounds like the definition of it.
Yeah, it does, Ange, doesn't it? It's sort of kind of the traditional description for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we never really know. It's when, you know, it's the old handshake deal. It's all a little bit opaque. But yeah, it absolutely is. I don't really care what they want to call it. That's totally what it is.
They can call it whatever they like, but you know,
yeah,
we listen to what people are saying. Look, it's really interesting also the way that this has played out for the Labor Party. I'd love to get both of your thoughts on this, because Labor's been in a lot of hot water over this today, getting a lot of criticism from the left, you know, people coming out and saying basically they've rolled over on this. And then equally, I suppose, from the government, that they've been wavering on all of this and had many positions. Steph, what do you think?
I find it quite baffling, actually, all this criticism of the Labor Party. I've seen so much of it on Twitter today, and you're right, people are so angry with Labor for doing what they've done. And okay, we all know Twitter isn't the real world, and I suspect most people out there, you know, picking up the newspaper or watching the nightly news won't have followed all the ins and outs and the, you know, myriad different positions Labor's had on this tax package. But at the end of the day, what were they really supposed to do? I mean, you know, their position was, you know, not to support the third wave of the tax package, or to, you know, maybe wave it through but then promise to repeal it. It just seemed to me that they tied themselves into an argument so early on in this period of opposition for them, well, period of opposition since the federal election. And it was a fight that they didn't really need to have. I mean, all the signs were there that the government would get this package through. And yet the news story, you know, for the better part of the past 3 or 4 weeks has been, you know, the Labor Party just kind of, you know, consuming itself over what it was going to do about this. And to me, it just seems a bit of a waste of time. And I kind of don't really see why people are so upset about it. I mean, yes, the third wave of the tax cuts does deliver, you know, a huge amount of money to people on higher incomes. And you can argue whether that is a good or a bad thing. But, you know, politics is the art of the possible, and it's a very pragmatic business. And when it looks as if, you know, something is going to go through, as it did with this one, to me, it just seems a little bit weird that you would, that you did seek to make yourself the story, particularly not a good story for something that you didn't really have any, you know, say in the final point.
And just part of the issue, though, they had a bet both ways.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. I think it's the optics of saying that you don't like something but passing it anyway. I mean, particularly when they had the option to take a principled stance because it was going to pass no matter what, so they weren't going to be, I guess, punished by, you know, angry people who are missing their $1,080 in a few weeks' time. You know, that wasn't going to splash back on them. They could have taken a sort of principled stance if they really didn't like the third tranche of this so much. I think the other thing to do with, you know, talking about the backlash from the left, part of that, I think, is just that they're not going to be, like, in the eyes of those people, Labor is just going to cop it for quite a while, I think, because people are still smarting. People on the left are still smarting about the election, and they're just going to take it out on, like, they're not going to be able to do anything right for quite some time, I think, particularly while they're still sort of in that review identity crisis period that they still seem to be in.
Yeah, there is a bit of an identity crisis. It does come down to that a bit too, doesn't it, Steph, that Labor's going to have to work out, and they say they reserve the right to figure it all out. And sure, everyone needs time. I mean, it makes sense. We've just had an election. But really their own view on taxation policy and flat tax and progressive tax and aspiration and where that should kick in. I mean, this is a much bigger soul-searching process for them.
Well, I mean, the entire, you know, policy suite and identity of the Labor Party is very much in a void at the moment. You know, the first thing that they said the day after they lost the election was that every single policy they took to the election will be open to review. And we all know that they had a very broad, far-reaching range of policies that they took to the election. A lot of them were extremely visionary. They were very big thinking. All of those are now gone. So, until they redevelop their policies and work out their positions on things, they essentially kind of have to fly by the seat of their pants. I think people need to remember it's not easy to develop a policy, particularly on something as complicated as taxation. That takes a lot of serious, serious grunt work. And when you're in opposition, you don't actually have that many staff. You don't have the resources of Treasury, for example, to do all the background research and, you know, all the different scenarios that might happen if you change X or Y or what have you. It's really, really difficult work. And to make it even harder for them, one of the greatest policy brains that they've had, who was Jenny Macklin, who was a front bencher and a minister for many years, she finished at the last election. So they no longer have her. I think it's going to be a difficult period for Labor for the next few months while they redevelop those policies and work out exactly what the things are that they want to define themselves on under Anthony Albanese's leadership.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis, and this is The Wrap. We're wrapping up a very big news week. Stephanie Peatling is one of our guests. She's from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Angela Voirpierre is also with us. She is the co-host of the Signal podcast. So, Angela, let's talk about your story, or the one that you took a big interest in. Early this week, you decided to revisit the question of whether Australia should have nuclear weapons, as you do. Why?
Yeah. Well, look, I blame Hugh White. So this is Professor Hugh White from ANU, wrote a book this week. And one of the, I guess, ideas in it is this, whether Australia needs to, I guess, consider whether it should be thinking about getting its nukes of its own. So for context, you know, a quick primer on nukes in the world. There's 8 countries, 9 if you count Israel, because they are technically undeclared, but there's 9 countries with nukes, but there are another 40 which are, I guess, what we call at the brink of manufacture, which is basically the industry term for being able to whip up a nuke at short notice.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. So I guess the principle here that Hugh White was talking about, and that we kind of explored in this episode, is that, you know, we're a super hard nation to defend. We've got a huge coast. We're an enormous land. We have allies, but they are literally on the other side of the world. And we never needed nukes, or we decided that we could do without them at least because we had the US to rely on. So a lot of, I guess, defense strategists are now mentally projecting a couple of decades into the future and going, okay, hang on, if the US is becoming less concerned with Asia and concerning itself in this sort of theater, I suppose, and then Australia innately becomes less valuable to them. So will they be as willing or maybe, you know, even as able when you contemplate, you know, the idea of their diminishing US power, which people will argue about till the cows come home. Will they be as willing or able to help us out of a jam in the future? And, you know, it takes a while to get nukes up and running. So it's if you do decide you want to do that, and if that is going to be a problem that you're going to have in a couple of decades' time, well, you know, you sort of need to start thinking about it now.
This is an interesting one, Steph. This is an area generally with a lot of bipartisanship in Australian politics. There's a lot of contest in so many other areas, taxation and welfare, but on this one there's a lot of bipartisanship. Is this even on the radar of either side of politics?
No, definitely not. And I, for one, am quite happy about that. I mean, I find the idea that we should acquire nuclear weapons simply because other people have them, you know, quite a frightening one. You know, I'm still kind of old enough, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, to remember that kind of Cold War, you know, the end of the Cold War build-up of America and Russia having nuclear weapons, and the kind of anxiety that used to provoke in people when they talked about it. I would like to, I appreciate and respect Hugh White's thinking about Australia's position in the region over the long term. I mean, he's spot on. It's such a difficult issue for us to work out how we play our relationship with China and America. And it's one that even senior policymakers don't seem to have grasped quite how to tackle in the future. But the idea that the easiest way to do it is to, you know, to start a weapons manufacturing industry of these incredibly dangerous, destructive weapons and somehow put them up, you know, around our borders as if that's going to distract people from, you know, attacking us. I find quite frightening. And, you know, both parties have had a very long opposition to that idea for pretty much the same reason. I would like to think that our policy makers and the people in government and opposition are able to come up with a better solution for our long-term future than, you know, acquiring weapons which have the ability to just cause untold destruction and human death and misery upon people.
And now for something completely different. Angela, you made your little brother do something all in the name of research. Let's take a listen.
Oh, God. Okay, here I go. Okay.
Interesting.
Doesn't taste like a fish at all. Doesn't taste like seafood.
No.
Tastes like, yeah, a mammal. It is a mammal. But. And texture is, like, fine.
Yeah, like beef.
And texture is like beef, yeah. It's actually good. It's actually not that bad, yeah.
Okay, just a warning to small children who are very passionate about our oceans, including my daughter, tune out right now. Tell me what he's doing.
That's a good warning. That's a very good warning. Mm-hmm. We probably should have had one of those at the top of today's episode. We didn't. My little brother is eating whale in that particular clip. So he lives over in Tokyo and he has done for a few years, but he'd never tried it before. And we, you know, of course, we're talking about this week because Japan has restarted commercial whaling as distinct from scientific whaling, which was the kind of pretense under which they did their whale hunt for the, you know, since the moratorium came in. Now, you know, you can hear his review there, and we were certainly interested to hear about the exact experience because I realised that we talk a lot about whaling without necessarily examining the end product. So that was one part of the episode. But the other thing, and by the way, so they sat there and he took a couple of mates with him to this place in Tokyo and they ate it and they kind of, and you know, they start eating and then they kind of have this like pang of guilt, like yes. after they've ordered and they go, oh, what are we doing? We're not really, oh, is it right? Is it wrong? Well, it's actually, you know, he's there with a couple of North Americans. And so he was explaining that it's this huge kind of moral thing in Australia, moral problem. And you know, people think that it's morally wrong. But you know, what they kind of said was, look, it's tasty, but it's probably not tasty enough to be eating an endangered species. And so that kind of brings us to the next question we really wanted to answer, which is what does the Japanese whaling program do to global whale populations? And the answer, I really didn't predict this. Basically, I was told that it was, and this is by a former chair of the International Whaling Commission, by the way, you know, no hack. And he told us that it's entirely sustainable, and it has been for quite some time. So they mainly kill minke whales. They're killing something like 220, I think, this year. There are a couple of other species in there, but predominantly minke, a small whale, and the stocks are very high. Norway and Iceland go the same way. And they're very robust populations, apparently. So I didn't know that.
No. Steph, what do you think?
Well, I hope my daughter wasn't listening to it either.
No, she actually wrote a BTN assignment this morning that she assigned to herself all about this very issue. So I'm immersed in this issue today.
Can't escape it.
And you know what we were doing, actually? The pros and the cons. Why, you know, the sort of the cultural explanation, of course, that some of the Japanese use, and the historical explanation, and some of the context that you just provided, Ange. I mean, it's a complex issue.
Yeah,
it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I think it's like when you go to a country such as France or Belgium, perhaps, and you might be served a steak that's come from a horse.
Or foie gras or something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, leaving aside the issue, let's assume that the whales that are being harvested for commercial use and consumption are not endangered and are being harvested in a sustainable and ethical way. That might be a big leap, but let's assume that. If you're a meat eater, then is it any different to eat a whale than it is to eat tuna or beef or
right? And then you get these
another form of flesh.
Yeah, you get these interesting sort of split ethical arguments within even meat eating, which is, you know, is a larger mammal, for example, do they experience pain in a more profound way? And is there therefore a bigger ethical question about this? But I think, you know, what Peter Bridgewater, who was the chair of the IWC, who we spoke to, you know, he pointed out was that the anti-whaling argument has been kind of hinged on conservation grounds. And that's maybe not the most solid ground for it to be built on. There are absolutely ethical arguments you could mount against whaling, but it turns out conservation is possibly slightly shakier ground than we realise.
All right, let's move on to another topic. As much as I could just talk about that all night, thanks to my 9-year-old. Steph, Australia has a new Governor General. Who are they? And tell me about why this is a big deal.
Yes, we do have a new Governor-General, our 27th. His name is David Hurley. He's the former head of the Australian Defence Force. He follows Sir Peter Cosgrove, who was another military man. He was sworn in at Parliament House in a very beautiful and old-fashioned, if you like it, ceremony. And he'll be the head of Australia, basically, although he has no power in terms of making legislation and so on. He's the Queen's representative in Australia. And I sat in the gallery to watch him being sworn in on Monday. And it's really fascinating for, you know, political nerds such as myself who really kind of enjoy this kind of thing. You kind of forget, you know, the kind of direct links that Australia still holds to Britain and the fact that it's a constitutional monarchy. And yet when you sit through that ceremony, the Governor General is sworn in not by the Prime Minister, but the Chief Justice of the High Court. He swears an oath of allegiance and office to the Queen and her heirs and successors, not to the democratically elected government. The way he phrases his first words is as if he was addressing Her Majesty. It's a really kind of interesting experience to sit there and be reminded about how close those ties between Australia and Buckingham Palace still are.
Yep.
I have a question.
Not a republic.
Yeah. No, definitely not.
Does the governor, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but it's just occurred to me hearing you speak about it. Does the Governor General actually have like any kind of lines of communication with the palace or is it
yeah,
very?
Yeah, he does.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow. There you go.
Just sit with that, people. Okay, make your own minds up. All right, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want some recommendations before I say goodbye to you both. Ange, what should I do on the weekend?
I think you should go and see John Wick 3 because that's what I've done. It's so gloriously dumb. It's an entire trilogy. Well, it's the third film in a trilogy premised on the death of a dog.
It's gloriously
stupid. It's like the perfect action movie as far as I'm concerned.
All right. I mean, Steph?
I'm on season two of Big Little Lies.
Oh, me too.
Which is amazing. It's based on Australian author Leanne Moriarty's book, which was the first, based on the first season. She's written the screenplay for the second season, which picks up exactly where season one ended. And it has Meryl Streep playing the mother-in-law from hell. And if you don't like that enough, it has possibly the best oceanfront real estate you will ever watch on television in your life.
All of it. It's amazing. Meryl Streep. How spooky, scary, menacing is she?
I know. She's just, when she shows up at this uninvited at a pumpkin carving party, you know, you just kind of want to jump into the television and strangle her.
Yes, it is
fabulous.
It is fabulous. Thank you to both of you. It's been excellent.
Thanks, BK.
Thank you.
And joining me tonight, Ange Lavoisier is the co-host of the Signal podcast, and Stephanie Peatling is the deputy federal editor in Canberra for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. This is RN Drive.